Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Douglas Blackman, author of Slavery by Another Name, The Reenslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II. Mr. Blackman is also the chairman of the University of Virginia's Miller Center Forum and is a contributing editor at the Washington Post. The topic of his presentation will be Slavery by Another Name. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, January 31st, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Center for Faith Studies, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Until 2011, Mr. Blackman was the longtime chief of the Wall Street Journal's Atlanta Bureau and the paper's senior national correspondent. He has written about or directed coverage of some of the most pivotal stories in American life, including the rise of the Tea Party movement and the BP oil spill. He and his team of reporters were responsible for the journal's acclaimed coverage of Hurricane Katrina and their investigation into the training and preparations of the 9/11 hijackers in Florida. Here now to introduce the program is Cindy Kugler, director of the Center for Faith Studies.
Here at Countryside, we often talk about finding our own sweet spot. Doing work passionately, work that is an expression of our own sense of mission and purpose. I don't think I overreach when I say that just that in our presenter's book. His book, his biography, and his successes are examples of that. Please help me welcome Mr. Douglas Blackman.
Thank you very much. That's a very kind introduction. I don't know that I deserve the term prophet, and I don't think we'll share anything with you that's prophetic, but I hope perhaps that there might be some aspect of revelation to it. And it's not the kindest or gentlest revelation, some of what I'll talk about in terms of our shared history as Americans, but I hope that... So I will afflict you a little bit with some of that, with that revelation, but I also will try to talk some about what drew me to write about these things and have an interest in these things and how it might be that that other people would contemplate them and maybe what they might mean for the world that we live in today. So not necessarily just a journey into the past. But thank you again for having me, and I particularly appreciate the arrangement of the balmy weather. When you're going to speak at a church and the weather turns against you, you have to question if someone is paying attention and isn't glad about it. But I hope that's not the case. As I prepared for my journey here, I started off this morning in Charlottesville, Virginia. But as I prepared for this trip, over the last few weeks, I often thought about what a good time it is to be back out with audiences like this one and a few others that I'll talk to over the next couple of months who care about some of the issues that I care most about at a time when, regardless of our political party allegiances, the re-election of President Obama, the implications of November's vote for future politics in America, the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, which just passed, of course, the success in the popular media of films like Lincoln and Django Unchained, whether you like them or not. I kind of like the first one, but have some questions about the second one. But all those things and others have really set the table, in my view, for truly meaningful conversations now among people. All sorts of people with varying views, I suspect, but who care the most about some of the things that really matter the most in our national life right now. And I would add, perhaps vainly, to that list of indicators of constructive conversation, the success of the film that I helped to make based on the book that I wrote, Slavery by Another Name, which premiered almost exactly a year ago, last week, at the Sundance Film Festival, and then received a huge audience, a shockingly large audience, when it was broadcast on PBS last February. There were almost 5 million people tuned in to watch that film the first week that it aired, and it will broadcast again nationally on February the 22nd. You can also watch it anytime at pbs.org, and there's no cost to see it, and there's no cost to to screen it to any group you might ever want to take it to, or for yourself. Your tax dollars and your gifts to public television have already paid, well, you've already purchased it. Before we get into the later conversation that will involve all of you, which really is my favorite part of the evening, though I do tend to take up most of the evening. I'm going to try hard not to do that tonight. But let me talk for a few minutes about not just the contents of the book, but what I call the persistent past. The past and how it insists on not being completely forgotten. And in addition to that, a subtitle that I like, and that is The Persistent Past, Reckoning with Our Racial History in the Era of Obama. So what does that mean? What am I talking about? What I mean is the question of what does a long and twisted history of racial discrimination and injury in our country mean at the dawn of a new time, a new century still, when an African-American holds our highest office, an African-American is our chief law enforcement officer, two African-Americans have served as secretaries of state in the past decade, African-Americans have held the highest positions in our military and judiciary, and at one point in the last election cycle, if you remember, the leading candidates to win the nominations of the Democratic and Republican parties for president were both African-American at one point. It was only for about a week that that Herman Cain was at the top of the polls. But that moment came. At the same time, we're at a moment in our history when an astonishing large and growing population of young people has no memory and little and perhaps no direct experience with the kind of racism and discrimination that once fundamentally defined American life and what it meant to be an American. Just a little more than 4 years ago, I made my way to Washington, D.C. To prepare for my role in covering the first inauguration of President Obama for the Wall Street Journal, where I worked for many, many years and had become senior national correspondent. On the day of the ceremony, which in fact was much colder than it is here today, I will say, but on the day of the ceremony 4 years ago, I was fortunate enough to be on the steps of the Capitol, near the base of the podium where the president took the ceremony, just a few feet away, really, from him, though beneath lower, in a small area along with Oprah Winfrey, Denzel Washington, Caroline Kennedy, Jesse Jackson, and several hundred other very fortunate people. I had snuck in. I wasn't supposed to be there, but it was a great vantage point. And behind us were 1.8 million Americans. In the paper the next day, I described the crowd as, quote, an undulating, glittering, flag-waving human blanket. Probably the most purple phrase of my career as a writer, but it was quite a day. On the Sunday night before the ceremony, I attended an event organized by Martin Luther King III, who was a good acquaintance of mine in Atlanta. And the event was attended by nearly all of the living legends of the civil rights movement. Ambassador Andrew Young, who of all the heroes of the movement still alive, knew Dr. King the very best, was closest to him. Congressman John Lewis, who, of course, was beaten nearly to death during the March on Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama in 1965, and who, when he was the same age as some of the younger members of the crowd tonight, was already emerging as a towering figure in the civil rights movement. And I would urge young people to remember just how young John Lewis was when he radically changed the world. And also there that night, I believe, was Julian Bond, who was one of the founders of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and who I happened to see last night at a ceremony honoring him in Virginia. But all of these luminaries and many others were there that night. And I walked over to Andrew Young, who I also know fairly well, and whose office in Atlanta at that time was in the same building that I worked in. And I crouched down beside Andy and I asked him how it felt for him that night. And we talked about how the event, in many ways, felt something like the standard civil rights banquet that we'd both attended 100 times in 100 different places. There was a gospel choir opening, an annual award to be handed out, an old lion of the civil rights movement preaching about how the struggle still wasn't over, tough piece of chicken on a hotel plate, a bit of a hollow sensation to those aspects. But then we stopped and we talked about how the program looked the same, but that the substance was so radically different and how everyone in the room knew it. a black president was about to be inaugurated. An event, and we talked about this, an event unlike almost every living American a year or two earlier could have imagined. Unlike every other American who couldn't imagine this event, this was something that Dr. King probably could have imagined, an event he could and should have witnessed. He would only be 84 years old today had he not been killed. An event that he would have agreed was a version of the mountaintop he preached about on the night before his assassination. Everyone in the room that night could feel some sense of that sensation, could feel the exhilarating sense of having arrived at the top of this highest, desperately sought-for peak, and not just by that meaning the election of a black president, but all that represented in that moment. And yet there was also this other feeling in the room, and one that anyone who has ever climbed a rock face or a tall hill or finished a grueling hike knows as well, and that is that having arrived at this magnificent place, difficult, magnificent place, where will we go now? What is the peak to aspire toward next? What do we do for those who couldn't make the climb? Who will go back down in the valley to get them? How will they do it without losing their way or slipping on the rocks? The way down is often as tricky as the journey up. Those are really the questions that I think compel much of our time and the national discourse that we should be in. In this extraordinary new moment, when so much has been accomplished, what do we do with the parts that haven't been accomplished? What do we do with the part? How do we even identify the things that have been accomplished? How do we sort out what still must be done and who has the duty to do it? And at the center of all of that is this question of what do we do about the past? Do we continue to discuss the discrimination and the injuries of the past, the bulk of which, the obvious elements of which are no longer happening, not in the way that they were long ago, and certainly not on the scale that they were in another time? But do we keep talking about that troubled past, or do we stop? Do we just stop talking about it? Let a new generation rise unburdened by that pain, not carry the scars caused by the errors and the evils of an earlier generation, an earlier time? What do we do with the terrible dilemma of the past? How much energy should I ask of you all to invest in a history like the one that I offer up in my book and in my film? Now, I'm guessing that my answer to that question is fairly predictable to you. And that would be that I would say you should spend a lot of time invested in my book and film. But I doubt that the facts of my book and film are as obvious to all of you as that may be. So why don't I take a few minutes now to talk about what those facts are, because I will tell you that in the time since I became an author, I have had to come to terms with something that I now realize every author since Moses has had to reckon with, and that is that not all of you have quite yet finished reading my book. Slavery by Another Name tells the story of how what I call a system of neo-slavery was resurrected after the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863 and the 15th Amendment of 1865 that were supposed to have ended slavery, and legally did, in a sense, and how involuntary servitude returned with shocking force and brutality to circumscribe the lives of millions of African Americans in the rural Deep South far into the 20th century. My central character is an obscure but completely real person, a black man named Green Cottenham, who was arrested on a fictitious charge of vagrancy on a cold morning in Shelby County, Alabama, in March of 1908. 5 months later, on August the 15th, Green's body was placed in a crude pine box and buried by convicts outside a forced labor coal mine near Birmingham, Alabama. He was one of hundreds of thousands of black men in the South forced into a new kind of involuntary servitude between the end of the Civil War and the beginning of World War II through perverse abuses of the judicial system, abuses that were explicitly designed and endorsed by most Americans as a new way to supply labor to new industry and farming and to intimidate African Americans away from their legal and political rights. The date of his death marked a cynical convergence of the very worst aspects of really all white Americans in all regions of our country. And that's an important thing to emphasize when we're far away from the Deep South, as we are tonight. And I talk about these things in lots of places around the country, and they're really interesting variations in the responses that I get, even among people who consider it, these things to be important and want to know about it. But there's still great variation in the way that people react to these things, and some of that has to do with where they are and whether they grew up around black people, or whether they've really known any black people, or whether they perceive these as being these issues as having been a history that happened down in the South and that was done by racist white people like my ancestors. But the truth is, the really hard, maybe the most uncomfortable aspect of this story beyond just the rank violence and banality of what was done is that the truth is that at the beginning of the 20th century, 1900, 1905, 1910, there essentially were no white people anywhere in America in any meaningful numbers who really believed that black people should have authentic citizenship. It just didn't exist. White people of America, including the people who had sacrificed so much in the Civil War to hold the Union together and bring an end to slavery, even among those people, there was a consensus that slavery had been a bad thing and that involuntary servitude should stop and that black people shouldn't be brutalized. But there was not a widespread view among white Americans that the black people should be true citizens. And the idea that they should truly have the vote and truly participate in American life, those were ideas that only the tiniest number of white people anywhere in America really held fast to. And that perhaps is one of the most uncomfortable things for people to reckon with. That date, that convergence of these terrible trends was happening all over America. Indeed, on the same day that Greene Cottingham died in Alabama, thousands of white people in Springfield, Illinois, the hometown of our most heroic and transforming president, Abraham Lincoln, major stop on the Underground Railroad, the city that had the largest black population anywhere in the Midwest in 1908, thousands of white people rose up August 15th, 1908, in an effort to force the entire black population of the city out of Springfield, Illinois. Almost all of the predominantly black residential areas of Springfield were burned. Black-owned businesses were looted. Dozens of men were shot or beaten. Two African Americans were lynched, including one infirmed old man who had once made shoes for Abraham Lincoln himself, but who in the 50 subsequent years had the temerity to become prosperous, to buy property, and to take as his wife a white woman, who bore and gave birth to multiracial children like Barack Obama. The mob, when they reached his house, because he was the wealthiest black man in Springfield, they broke down the front door of the house seeking him. Wife denied that he was there. They charged in, found him, dragged him, he was an old man, dragged him out into the front yard, slit his neck, in front of his family, and then hung him from a tree where he died, hanging in the tree. And then after he died, they cut the body down, and the tree was cut into tiny pieces of wood and then distributed as souvenirs to the mob. And there's still some folks in Springfield, Illinois, who know that back in the closet somewhere, there's somebody who they still have one of those souvenir pieces. But those were events that Springfield, Illinois, aside from a very few people who knew something about that little souvenir, you know, in the cigar box somewhere, those were events that in Springfield and so many other places, because those sorts of things happen all over the place, in almost every part of America at one point in time or another, but particularly in the Midwest and parts of the Northeast. But those events were ones that in Illinois, like so many other places, America tried to forget in the succeeding decades. And indeed, by the time that Barack Obama arrived in Springfield as a state legislator, those memories had all but vanished of what had happened in Springfield. Almost no living person in Springfield remembered anymore that any of that had happened. So Mr. Obama had no idea, I'm almost certain, when he announced his candidacy for the White House on the steps of the old Illinois State Capitol in 2007, that he did so directly across the street from the place where the mob first organized 99 years earlier and began its rampage. In 1908, more than 40 years after the ostensible end of slavery, a new national white consensus had coalesced against African Americans. The general white public, the national leadership of the Republican Party, Democrats had long before embraced these ideas, And the federal government on every level were arriving at the conclusion that African Americans did not merit citizenship and that their freedom was not valuable enough to justify the conflicts that they engendered among whites. Whites across the nation concluded that blacks were essentially not worth the cost of imposing a racial morality that few in any region genuinely shared. That's the essence of slavery by another name. And it's a story that, for the most part, few living Americans have known. Indeed, we've only just now begun to fully understand some of these contours and the width and the breadth and banality of all that was done to harm African Americans in ways that still vividly shape the world that we live in and the lives of people, because we're talking about events that continued to the beginning of World War II. We're talking about these are things that happen to people who are still alive. You know, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of African Americans who were born on a sharecrop farm or some other place in South Alabama or South Georgia. Dr. King was born in the 1920s. He was born, he was a city boy, but if he'd been born in the country like his father, then he would have been born in a place that was at least shaped and drawn by these events and these practices. And so these are events that directly impacted people who are still alive today, and even beyond that, certainly shaped the world that we live in and the disparities that persist. If you'll indulge me for a second, let me just read a few paragraphs from the introduction of the book. On March 30th, 1908, Green Cottenham was arrested by the sheriff of Shelby County, Alabama, and charged with the crime of vagrancy. Cottenham had committed no true crime. Vagrancy, the offense of a person not being able to prove at a given moment that he or she is employed, was a new and flimsy concoction, dredged up from legal obscurity at the end of the 19th century by the state legislatures of Alabama and other southern states. It was capriciously enforced by local sheriffs and constables, adjudicated by mayors and notaries public, recorded haphazardly or not at all in court records, and most tellingly, in a time of massive unemployment among all southern men, was reserved almost exclusively for black men. His offense, his true offense, was blackness. After 3 days behind bars, 22-year-old Cottenham was found guilty in a swift appearance before the county judge and immediately sentenced to a 30-day term of hard labor. Unable to pay the array of fees assessed on every prisoner, fees to the sheriff, the deputy, the court clerk, the witnesses who testified against him, his sentence was extended to nearly a year. The next day, Cottenham, the youngest of 9 children born to former slaves, was sold. Under a standing arrangement between the county and a vast subsidiary of the industrial titan of the North, U.S. Steel Corporation, the sheriff turned the young black man over to the company for the duration of his sentence. In return, the subsidiary, Tennessee Coal, Iron, and Railroad Company, gave the county $12 a month. What the company's managers did with Cottenham and thousands of other black men they acquired from sheriffs across Alabama was entirely up to them. A few hours later, the company plunged Cottenham into the darkness of a mine called Slope No. 12, one shaft in a vast subterranean labyrinth on the edge of Birmingham known as the Pratt Mines. There, he was chained inside a long wooden barrack at night and required to spend nearly every waking hour digging and loading coal. His required daily task was to remove 8 tons of coal from the mine. Cottenham was subject to the whip for failure to dig the requisite amount, at risk of physical torture for disobedience, and vulnerable to the predations of other miners, many of whom already had passed years or decades in their own Chthonian confinement. The lightless catacombs of black rock, packed with hundreds of desperate men, slick with sweat and coated in pulverized coal, must have exceeded any vision of hell a boy born in the countryside of Alabama, even a child of slaves, could have ever imagined. Waves of disease ripped through the population. In the month before Cottenham arrived at the prison mine, pneumonia and tuberculosis sickened dozens. Within his first 4 weeks, 6 died. Before the year was over, almost 60 men forced into Slope 12 were dead of disease, accidents, or homicide. Most of the broken bodies, along with hundreds of others before and after, were dumped into shallow graves scattered among the refuse of the mine. Others were incinerated in nearby ovens used to blast millions of tons of coal. 45 years after President Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation freeing American slaves, Green Cottenham and more than 1,000 other black men toiled under the lash at Slope 12. Imprisoned in what was then the most advanced city of the South, guarded by whipping bosses employed by the most iconic example of the modern corporation emerging in the Gilded North, they were slaves in all but name. So this is not the version of history that most of us have been taught. In fact, most conventional historical interpretation about this period of time, though it's a terribly underexamined period of our history, has been to view the events of the early 20th century as they related to race as a series of disconnected Southern practices. Dissertations are written on peonage, sharecropping, prison labor, antebellum industrial slavery, racial violence, political intimidation, lack of schools, the rise of white supremacy, things you've heard about. Each of these things have often been treated by historians as separate phenomena, to be sliced and diced and analyzed by regions and periods of time in ways that inadvertently but consistently minimize the totality of the South's regime of coercion against African Americans. They accept a kind of inevitability to the bad things done to African Americans, as if these were unavoidable outcomes of social habits and prejudices that in the end were somehow vaguely predictable and understandable. Bad things that weren't really intentional and that simply had to be waited out until our society had outgrown them. That took a lot of overlooking fact and poor vision. The total number of workers caught up in this net is impossible to precisely identify. But I have found records that speak to hundreds of thousands of individuals in county courthouses and other places all across the South that had essentially gone unexamined by most historians. Repeatedly, the timing and scale of these arrests and this use of the courts to provide free or almost free labor to these big commercial enterprises, repeatedly the timing and scale of these surges and arrests were much more attuned to rises and dips in the need for cheap labor than any demonstrable evidence of crime. These were not criminals who were being harshly punished. I mean, there were a few. There were some. You know, when there's a murder and there's a dead body on the floor, somebody killed them. There's a murderer somewhere. So there were criminals who were punished in this way, and there were some white people who found themselves drawn into this system as well. But overwhelmingly, this was a fate that was reserved for black men, and it happened when business needed more black men at very low cost. By 1900, the South's judicial system had been wholly reconfigured to make one of its primary purposes the coercion of African Americans to comply with the social customs and labor demands of whites. And the terror that this might happen was essential then to forcing African Americans away from the voting booth, away from the courts, and away from exercising their civil rights and their then willingness to abide the other kinds of exploitative labor that we know more about, like sharecropping. It also generated giant amounts of money, vast amounts of money, vast profits for the companies who were involved in it, and tremendous amounts of money for the county governments and sheriffs and state governments who facilitated it. In all the southern states, eventually, there were these elaborate systems in which thousands and thousands and thousands of men were being sold into involuntary servitude. And one of the side effects of that was that it recreated the old system, the old commercial systems of slavery, the wholesalers and retailers and all the different roles that had existed with slavery before the Civil War. Well, that economic system resurrected itself. When you create a market, then you create a value for the product, and the product in this system was a strong black man who could be forced into labor. And this new system placed a value on those men, and that value was about $50 to $100, typically, whereas in antebellum slavery, the value of black men had been vastly more, so valuable that, in fact, the value of an enslaved man actually served to protect an enslaved person in some respects, because a person who bought a man or a woman didn't want to lose that investment. But in this new system, there was no real value, no significant value attached to these individuals. And so they could be worked to the very edge of human capacity, and they were worked to death with such incredible frequency. The mortality rates in these work camps were often 30 and 40% a year. And so to be sent into one of the 50 or 60 forced labor camps in Georgia at the beginning of the 20th century was like rolling the dice for a 50-50 odds of whether you would be alive a year later. It was a terrifying, terrifying thing that sapped so much talent and energy and ambition and potential out of African-American communities and damage the larger community that existed as well. In the state of Alabama, for many, many years, the revenue that was derived from these practices was the single largest source of revenue for the state of Alabama for decades. It's an astonishing fact. On July 31st, 1903, a letter to President Theodore Roosevelt arrived at the White House from a woman named Carrie Kinsey, barely literate African-American in Bainbridge, Georgia. Her 14-year-old brother, James Robinson, had been abducted a year earlier and sold to a plantation. Local police would take no interest. "Mr. President," wrote Mrs. Kinsey, struggling to overcome the illiteracy of her world, "they won't let me have him. He has not done nothing for them to have him in chains, so I write to you for your help." Now pause for a moment and imagine this letter and the context that it was written in. Here you have, imagine yourself, I have a 15-year-old son, so imagine yourself. You have a 14-year-old sibling who has been kidnapped and sold into slavery. And you know who kidnapped him? He hasn't even been charged with a crime. He's just been kidnapped and sold into slavery. Because this system has become so pervasive that there's an established value in every young black man. And so you don't even have to pretend anymore that they've committed a crime. You can just snatch them, sell them to the people who are in the business of buying people who have been convicted. And so this has happened to your 14-year-old sibling. And you've been to the sheriff, and you've probably been to the postmaster, who's maybe the most friendly person in your world to a poor black person. You've been to the store owner at the nearby country store where you probably trade. You've been to the people you have some level of confidence in, and nobody will take any interest in this because this is just how things work now. It's the 20th century. This is how it works. So no one will do anything to assist you and to then reach a point of desperation so great that the only thing you can think of left to do is to write a letter to the President of the United States. That just is astonishing. When I found that letter, I just stopped cold. It's by far the most affecting artifact of all the thousands of things that I came across and read in the course of the years that I've spent on this. But like the vast majority of such pleas, and there are 30,000 of them in the National Archives, her letter was slipped into a small rectangular folder at the Department of Justice and tagged with a reference number, 12007. No further action was ever recorded. Her letter lies in the National Archives today. A world in which the seizure and sale of a black man, even a black child, was viewed as neither criminal nor extraordinary, had reemerged. Millions of blacks lived in that shadow as forced laborers or their family members, or African Americans simply in terror of the system's caprice. This practice would not begin to fully recede from their lives until the dawn of World War II. So that's the terrible history that my book is about, and the film is about. Perhaps I should talk a little bit about why I wrote this book, why I took an interest in it. In fact, I'm certain that there's someone in the room who's already framing a question that, based on past experience, goes along the lines of, why would a white guy from the Mississippi Delta, who worked most of the past 20 years for Rupert Murdoch at the most conservative newspaper in America, write this book? And the answer to that is complicated, as you can imagine. But all the versions of the answer to that go back to where I come from in one way or another, and that is the Mississippi Delta, and which you may know what that is or not, but that's the most fertile, flat-plained, in some respects, Nebraska-like looking landscape of the Mississippi Delta, but of the South. But whatever image you may have in your mind of a cotton plantation, it is an image of the Mississippi Delta. And by far the most productive cotton land probably in the world, certainly in North America. And a place that where there were more black people than white in the world that I grew up in. And a twisted and difficult set of circumstances that surrounded the lives of both black people and white in that place. I was not a part. My family was not a planter family. My dad worked for the government. But I was a child of the Mississippi Delta and a descendant of Southerners who never owned slaves, as far as I know, and that actually is not something that really matters, but who fought for the Confederacy as privates and grunts and such in largely unrecorded ways, and then passed generations on obscure farms in North Carolina and Alabama, Arkansas, and finally ended up in Louisiana, and then I ended up back in Mississippi. But I was born in the Delta in the fall of 1964, when the South was convulsing through the darkest hours of the Civil Rights Movement. Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney had been murdered by the Klan not all that far away a few months earlier. Within a year after I was born, a group of black farm workers, many of whom still lived in desperate 19th century conditions in 1964 and 65, no power, no running water. This is hard to believe, and I used to not believe it myself, but I have come to accept that it is true. There were African Americans on plantations, big, vast plantations in the Delta in 1964 and 65, who, when civil rights workers first visited there, told the civil rights folks that they had never seen U.S. currency. I used to not believe that, but now I think that I do. But this group of folks went on strike in 1965. They were evicted from their homes on the plantation. They set up a tent encampment first, and then they built little houses out in the country. They were attacked by the Ku Klux Klan. The men were never allowed to work in the county again for their entire lives. The place came to be known as Strike City, and it was briefly at the center of media attention around the civil rights movement, and then it was largely forgotten. Most of the strikers died over the years, though there's still two strikers alive who are still out at Strike City, amazingly. But that was in 1965, and it turned out that I went to school. I didn't know it for a long time, but I went to school with some of the children of Strike City. But in 1969, a group of black students who were protesting that the schools in our town were still completely segregated 15 years after the Brown decision, so a group of black students staged a very peaceful march from the black high school, Abraham Lincoln High, to the white high school. And as they arrived at the white campus singing a song peacefully, they were tear gassed by the redneck police chief of the town. And a melee ensued, and there were fights that broke out, and windows were broken. And at one point, a 16-year-old African-American boy burst through the front door of a feed and seed store not too far away, and the white man behind the counter pulled a pistol out, shot him in the door. The young man survived, but there was never an investigation. No one was ever charged. Finally, after a Supreme Court ruling later in 1969 that forced the immediate desegregation of my town schools and 29 other districts in Mississippi and ultimately pretty much every school system in the South, the schools were finally fully integrated in 1970, and I began the first grade in the fall of 1970. And so I was in the first class of children in Mississippi to begin the first day of first grade, black and white together, and go through 12 grades of public education with black kids and white kids in the same classroom. Now, of course, I was a child. I didn't know about any of that when it was happening. Had no awareness whatsoever of any of the things that I've just told you, except that I did know something was up. You know, so something really, really big was up, and nobody would explain what it was. And in particular, I was aware that all the African American kids were mad at me for some reason, and I couldn't pinpoint what it was. And so all the white kids were mad back at them, even though we couldn't really figure out what exactly we were mad about either. But it also occurred to me that I was one of the small group of white families who were going to the public schools. And so also all these other white kids, the majority of the white kids that I knew at church and everywhere else, they were mad at me too. For some reason, I couldn't put my finger on. You know, so I was kind of mad back at them. So we had this very tense, complicated world in which I went to a school that had far more black people in it than white. And I really knew more black people than I did white people as a child. But every other aspect of my life remained archly segregated. Little League baseball, the swimming pool owned by the city was still segregated. The church that I went to was all white. Every aspect of life remained completely segregated except this experience in public school. And at a pretty early age, I was trying to understand why that was. What was that all about? Why did my family live, even though we were a very modest family, but why did we live so differently nonetheless than all these black families who lived right around the corner from us? You know, why were there all these terrible things that all these black folks had to deal with, including the kids I was mad at, that I clearly was not going to have to deal with? Why were things the way that they were? Why was there all this anger that was there as well? And so I started asking questions about this for whatever reason. I don't know why I was compelled by all this, but I was. My brothers were not. And most of the kids I knew were not. But I began to ask a lot of questions about why are things the way they are. And those were not welcome questions at all, coming from a young boy. And in the seventh grade, there was an essay contest sponsored by the County Historical Society. It was the sesquicentennial of Washington County. And so the Historical Society, which, of course, is a bunch of little old white ladies, organized this essay contest, and any student at any school in the county could submit an essay on any topic related to the history of the county, wide open. And so for some reason, I wrote an essay, a short little seventh grader's essay, about Strike City, about that farm labor strike in 1965. Now, to this day, I don't know how I even knew that that event had occurred, because it was 10 years past by then, and no white person would have ever spoken of it, certainly not to a child. But somehow I knew about it, and I got interested in it, and I wrote this little simple little essay about it, and submitted it for the contest. And a few weeks later, a letter arrived in the mail with my name on it, amazing event in the 1970s for a child. Open up the letter, read it. I had won second place, third place, something like that, in the essay contest. And I was to go to the county fair on a particular day, particular place, and Mrs. Baker, the writer, the author of the letter, and meet Mrs. Baker there, and she would escort me to the award ceremony. And she was going to be wearing a blue dress. The letter told me that. And so when the appointed day came, my mother dropped me off at the county fair, something maybe in Nebraska you can, still can, but something I wouldn't do with my 12-year-old today. I was dropped off at the county fair. I made my way to the place, and there was Mrs. Baker. It was obviously her, this middle-aged white lady in blue dress, standing around looking for people. But I was too timid, suddenly, to walk up and introduce myself. I was afraid that she would not be Mrs. Baker, and I would be embarrassed. And so I stood there for a long time waiting for her to notice me. And she looked at me several times, no hint of recognition, so I thought it must not be Mrs. Baker. Finally, another little white boy comes walking along who I knew through church circles, and they immediately recognized each other. He went to one of the SEG academies, these private schools that popped up overnight to try to preserve segregated white schools. And he went to one of those, but I knew him from church. And they immediately began talking about the essay contest, and I realized, that is Mrs. Baker. And so I walk up finally, bravely now, and introduce myself. And I don't know if I realized it in the instant that she looked into my eyes or if I figured it out later, but it dawned on me that by virtue of the topic of my essay, the fact that I attended an overwhelmingly black school, the oddity of my last name, I was supposed to have been the little black boy getting a certificate that day. So I have always considered myself an early beneficiary of affirmative action. So the next year, the town oratorical contest came around, and I decided to give a speech in the town oratorical contest based on my award-winning essay of the previous year. And the Lions Club sponsored this speech contest every year. I won the junior high school part of the competition. And the finals were for the two finalists from the high school and the one from the junior high school to give our speeches to a meeting of the Lions Club, and the winner would be selected. So the day came, and the three of us went to give our speeches, and the two high school girls both gave the kinds of uplifting speeches about new generation for the future that a high school kid is supposed to give. And then I got up and gave my speech about Strike City. Now, in my mind, my eighth grade mind, these events, even though they were only 10 or 12 years past that point, but they were ancient history in my mind. And in fact, even though I had gone out and interviewed the plantation owner in the course of writing the essay at one point, and I talked to a couple of other living people who had been related to those events, in my mind, they were all dead, even though I had talked to some of them. This was just ancient, dead history that no one could possibly still have any concerns about. It was a curiosity, not something of any power. So I got up and I gave my speech, and I told the story of the strikers and the Ku Klux Klansmen attacking them, and then it ended triumphantly with how the civil rights movement came along, and they were liberated from these conditions, and everything worked out well. Now, as soon as I started giving the speech, though, I realized that something, again, was up. because in the really serious parts of the speech, the men in the room, these 45, you know, white guys, middle-aged white guys, they would kind of snicker in these places that, you know, that weren't funny. And then in the uplifting, serious parts, they were just dead silent. Of course, it had not ever crossed my mind that I might be giving my speech to the Ku Klux Klansmen who had attacked the civil rights workers. But in fact, that's exactly what I was doing. I did not win, as you might imagine. But afterwards, we all lined up for the handshake line, you know, afterwards, the three of us, and all the men filed by shaking our hands, telling us we did a good job. But there was this one fellow who hung back the whole time, and I sort of noticed him out of the corner of my eye, but all adults were mysterious to me at that point, so I didn't know what he was up to. And then finally, he waited until all the others had gone by, and then he rushed up and lit into me. You know, where did you get all that stuff, boy? You know, who told you all that? Nothing like that happened. You know, did your mom and daddy tell you those things? And he got more and more vociferous and, you know, gesticulating around and bumping into me. And the way that I remember him, he was about 8 feet tall, and he had a shock of white hair, and was about 90 years old. And I strongly suspect he looked very similar to how I look right now in reality. But finally, at some point, my teacher, my advisor, wedged herself between the two of us and said something to the guy, and he spun around and took off out the door. And again, I was just, you know, wow, what was that about? You know, I made no sense to me whatsoever. But then a few days later, another letter comes in the mail, another mystery letter. This time it's from the president of the Lions Club. And it's this elaborate apology about the incident that had occurred, et cetera, et cetera. And I read the letter, and again, I was completely mystified. I had no idea, really, what any of this was all about. Just more mysterious adult behavior. But I did notice a year later when the Lions Club never again sponsored the town oratorical contest. That was the end of the Leland, Mississippi Lions Club oratorical contest. Many years later, I decided to go back to the town and take some assessment. My family was long gone by then, by the 1990s, and I had sort of become disconnected from the place because once I was out of high school, I really never went back in a meaningful way. So I decided to go back about 20 years after those events and take the measure of what had happened and, you know, what had really been accomplished by this. Because by then, I had figured out that I was in this inaugural class of blacks and whites who started school together and went all the way through. Something I had not known until I was in college, but I'd figured that out, and I decided to go back and assess what it had all added up to, a lot of which surprised me. But I ended up writing a long essay about that, essentially those events that I've just told you, most of them, many of which I had not known about before, and that was published in Harper's Magazine in 1992. In fact, the book that I'm writing now is sort of an elaboration on all of that. Hope to make a film related to it as well. But after that essay was published in Harper's, the folks in my hometown obviously were not all that thrilled about it. Some of them, and the man who had been the mayor of the town through almost all of my childhood, wrote a letter to the editor in which he said that no one in my hometown could remember any of the events described in the essay that I had just published. Not a single thing, not one single event could anyone remember. So it was a lesson to me. A lot of things have been lessons to me about how hard we work to not remember things. Because he was probably telling the truth when he said that he couldn't remember any of it. Nobody else could remember any of it. There was a version of that was true to him. He couldn't remember any of it because it was all so inconsequential to him in reality. And so it just sort of faded away. And he couldn't remember a bit of it. But as Americans, we've been trained to work at forgetting a lot of things. And what I say to you tonight and what I hope my book helps to do in a very authoritative and scholarly way is to just stand against that unapologetically. It's a challenge to the idea to anyone who would minimize this history or deny the history that I was talking about earlier And I reject the idea that we can pretend that those events are so distant and so remote that they really don't matter. When the reality is that if we're at all sincere about the things that something that almost all of us, I think, generally agree on, we all generally agree, almost everybody in America agrees on some version of this idea of where our country ought to be going and the better place we want it to be and this place that that regardless of what you think about whether there's opportunity now, we all agree that there should be equal chances for people in the future, and we're going to be happier if more people have more success, and we don't want there to be unnecessary obstacles in the path of any Americans. We all agree on some version of that vision. But if we're sincere about that, if we're sincere about trying to get our country to that place, then we also have to be able to be honest about why things are the way they are now. And the history that I've been talking about tonight is inextricably necessary to understanding the disparities that still exist between the economic achievements and educational attainment of African Americans and white Americans and other groups. If you want to understand why things really are the way they are, unless you're a white supremacist, unless your explanation is that white people are just smarter, and then end of story. Well, then you're set if that's what you think. That's your explanation. But if that's not what you think, then there's got to be some other explanation. And it's not that black people haven't worked hard enough, or that they don't have aspirations. It's not any of those things. And so when you've been in that conversation with someone, as all of us have been in, where somebody, maybe we ourselves, have said, "Why do black people have to keep talking about slavery? When are they going to stop? When is Jesse Jackson going to stop complaining about all this stuff? Stop talking about slavery." Well, the reality is that, and then when someone says slavery ended 150 years ago, well, no, it didn't. No, it didn't. The reality of slavery, the reality of involuntary servitude, and the damage that it did in terms of economic terms, and the restraint of people to exercise their liberty and to leverage the mechanisms of opportunity in America, the reality is that the widespread ability of African Americans to tap into the ways that white people and families like mine rose out of poverty between the 1910s and the 1950s, those mechanisms were not available to the vast majority of black people in America until about 1970. 1970, a solid 100 years after the end of slavery. And slavery itself, real live slavery, buying and selling people slavery, didn't really stop until the 1940s, stop in a significant way until the 1940s. And so if we're honest with ourselves and we're honest about where we want our country to go and figuring out a way there, if we're honest about how to find the next peak and the route there, if we're honest about that, sincere about it, then we're going to be able to come to terms with these are things that we have to understand and we have to be willing to reset the clock on our comprehension of these events. So I'm going to stop with one last thing. Not long after my book was first published, I got an email from someone I've never met, but who was a descendant of a man in Atlanta named Joel Hurt, who was one of the great pioneers of creating modern Atlanta. Very, very wealthy family, still very wealthy. And by the way, none of these things, say very quickly, nobody's responsible for what the grandfather did or the great-grandfather did. Nobody carries any burden, and I don't suggest that any of us have any moral injury from something that our ancestors did. Now, how we respond to the knowledge that things happened in the past, that may be a test of our character. But I don't suggest in any way that because somebody's family did something a long time ago that says something about them. We all have only our own conduct to account for. But this woman wrote me, a school teacher, actually from somewhere in the Midwest, as I recall. But this email pops up about this figure in the book who had made his fortune through these terrible practices at the beginning of the 20th century. And she wrote me, "Dear Mr. Blackman, I'm the great-great-granddaughter of Joel Hurt, this man. I have only just discovered your book. I have found everything possible about it on the web, including this fascinating website. I'm trying to muster the courage to read your book. Just reading excerpts has been quite painful. Needless to say, this is a very emotional subject for us, as we did not know of any of this before. But in the meantime, I'm writing because I want to thank you for having written it. I have had that same photo of great-great-grandfather hanging on my wall for years, and have always been proud of his participation in rebuilding Atlanta after the Civil War. But I believe that the ghosts of slavery and racism and the terrorism inflicted within our own country must not be hidden away, but brought out into the open. I am so grateful to learn more of the truth of my family's past. Without the whole truth, we live only in illusions, and I would hate to live my life perpetuating illusions, especially such horrific ones whose ramifications continue today. I remain proud of where I come from, but humbled by the realities you brought to light. And I thank that reader for her vote of confidence, and I thank all of you for listening to me tonight.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the Center for Faith Studies on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Douglas Blackman, author of Slavery by Another Name, The Reenslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II. Mr. Blackman is also the chairman of the University of Virginia's Miller Center Forum and is a contributing editor at The Washington Post. The topic of his presentation was Slavery by Another Name. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, January 31st, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Kugler, director of the Center for Faith Studies, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.